Turning his head so quickly that it spun his body about, Dan saw a scalpel-thin line etching itself slowly across the top of the Russian shuttle, angling across its white body just forward of the root of the rakishly angled tail fin. "Inner airlock has been opened," Cockton's voice reported over the intercom grill built into the control board. "They are entering main section."
"Are they in suits?" Dan asked.
"No spacesuits. Only soldier unit." "Ah! One of them shot out the camera. Barbarian thugs."
"Have you taken all the spacesuits out of the lockers?"
"Yes, yes," Cockton's replied, sounding almost miffed at the question. "Just as you ordered. All suits here in control center with us. No suits anywhere else in factory."
"Good. Fine. We'll be back there with you in about 5 minutes."
"Better hurry. There are about 30 of them, and they are shooting out TV cameras as they spread through factory."
"We're done here," the technician said, pulling a fresh cigar from his chest pocket.
Dan saw that the dark-edged cut had sliced completely across the shuttle's rear end.
That should do it, he thought.
When they try to light up their engines to get back home, they'll find out that they're stuck here. They can limp back to Nueva Venezuela on their maneuvering thrusters if they have enough fuel left in them, but they can't retroburn and return to Earth.
"Okay," Dan said, clapping the technician on the back hard enough to send his new cigar spinning out of his mouth.
"Let's haul ass back to the control center."
Vasily Malik stood uneasily in the vast, echoing, gloomy expanse of the space factory's main workshop. The machines were still and silent. The big, high-vaulted chamber was only dimly lit. Most of the lamps set up among the curving ribs of the ceiling had been turned off. Malik was accustomed to weightlessness, but he did not enjoy it. He was not an astronaut or engineer who had to learn how to work in zero gravity. He was a government official who experienced zero-G when he traveled into space and much preferred to feel some solid weight, even the feather-like pull of the moon, and to know in his guts that up was up and down was down. Now he stood alongside a huge pile of machinery, heavy metal beams and grasping arms that looked like a giant robot's workbench. The chamber felt chilly to Malik, as if the cold and darkness of the void outside were seeping into it. "Nonsense," he told himself. "Randolph thinks that he has me at a disadvantage here. But he will soon learn that I can ferret him out here or anywhere else that he tries to hide from me." One of the young lieutenants came gliding up to him and stopped himself only by grabbing at the edge of the aluminum beam next to where Malik stood.
"They have evacuated every section my men have searched, sir," said the lieutenant a little breathlessly. "The place is empty."
"They are here," Malik insisted. "They must have retreated farther, into those pods on the far side of the factory."
"Yes, sir," agreed the lieutenant.
Malik saw that more than a dozen soldiers were milling around the outer areas of this big shadowy chamber, bobbing slightly in the weightlessness. He pulled a flat, slim, portable computer about the size of a hand from his back pocket and touched a button at its base. Its display screen glowed to life.
"According to the plan of this place," he said as the lieutenant peered over his shoulder, "we have entered the factory from here, the main airlock, and worked our way to here, the machine shop."
"Yes, sir," the lieutenant pointed with an extended finger.
"My men have come along this section, past the control center and living quarters, while the other squad has come through this way, where the communications and life support centers are."
"And they are all empty. No one in them."
"That is correct, sir."
"You left men at the communications and life support centers?"
"Yes, sir, as you ordered."
Malik studied the computer screen.
"Good.
They must be hiding out in these arms, where the smelters and lasers are located."
"If they're here at all, sir," ventured the lieutenant.
"Oh, he's here," Malik said. "I can smell him. He's here, cowering in some dark corner like a trapped rat."
"Malik!"
The word boomed through the sepulchral chamber like the voice of God.
"Vasily Malik, can you hear me?"
Looking up into the eerie shadows of the steel-ribbed ceiling, Malik shouted,
"Randolph, where are you?"
"I'm at your jugular vein, Malik." Without thinking about it consciously, Malik pulled his pistol from the holster at his hip.
"Give yourself up, Randolph. Surrender yourself, and there will be no more bloodshed. Let Lucita go. There's no reason for you to hold her as a hostage."
"You've got it all wrong, friend," Randolph's voice boomed from the loudspeakers in the ceiling.
"You're the one who has to surrender. You've led your men into a trap."
"Don't try to bluff your..."
"Haven't you noticed that it's getting cold in there? I've turned down the air pressure."
The young lieutenant stared at Malik, his mouth hanging open. Your shuttle is crippled, and all the passageways leading back to the main airlock have been opened up to vacuum as of now. Malik heard the clang of airtight hatches slamming shut and the distant muffled klaxons that warned of air pressure loss. It's an old Russian strategy, Randolph chuckled. Lead the enemy into your territory and scorch the earth behind it. You're trapped, pal. If I want to, I can pop open the emergency hatches in there. Ever see what happens to a human body when it's suddenly exposed to vacuum? It's called explosive decompression. Not pretty. You're bluffing. We have occupied the control center, the life support center. Sure you have. But I had the equipment in them disconnected before we retreated back here. We're running everything from the emergency backup equipment out here in the smelter pod. I don't believe you. Randolph's laugh grated against Moloch's nerves. You don't believe me? Then go pry open one of the hatches. Blow it open with a grenade if you're carrying any. I only wish I had a working camera in there so I could see you when your skin bursts and your eyes blow out of your head. You've killed my men? Not yet. They're locked into the communications and life support centers. The airtight hatches will keep them safe, as long as they don't try to get out. Malik fought down a wave of fear-driven fury that threatened to engulf him. He took a deep breath and looked down at the pistol in his hand until he was quite certain that it was not trembling. Still, his palms felt slick with perspiration. This delaying action won't prevent the inevitable, Randolph, he said, feeling frustrated and having to talk into the shadows. Soviet spacecraft are on their way here with more troops. Are they? Dan's voice cut in. You'd better come up here and take a look. What do you mean? Go to the airlock hatch labeled number 4. Enter it. We'll cycle the hatch from here. Follow my instructions when the other side opens and I'll lead you here to the smelter pod. Moloch's eyes scanned the perimeter of the big, darkened chamber. He saw a hatch with the numeral 4 glowing in white above it. Come alone, Dan's voice warned, and leave your gun behind. Chapter 40. From the control station high above the main smelters, Dan watched the TV monitors as Malik made his way along the long tubular passageway from the main machine shop to the smelter pod. As far as he could see, the Russian was unarmed. His holster flapped emptily. But there were plenty of places to hide a weapon inside the tunic, pants, and boots of his uniform. And he claims to be a martial arts expert, Dan reminded himself. You'll have to search him, he said to Coctans. The Latvian nodded, a lopsided grin on his face. It will be new experience for me for Russian to be prisoner. Most of the men and women of the factory complex were gathered down in the smelter area where ordinarily raw ores from the moon were melted down and separated into their constituent aluminum, titanium, silicon, oxygen, and other elements. But now the smelters were cold and quiet, their huge maws gaping blankly, the conveyor belts that fed them unmoving. The control center was a curving tube built above the big blackened smelters. Row upon row of consoles and monitoring panels lined its length and wrapped themselves all around the circular inner walls, except for a long slit of a window that looked out on the smelters themselves. Built for zero-gravity operation, the control center contained no chairs at all, only occasional posts jutting out from the consoles, like perches for birds, where the technicians could roost and anchor themselves for a while. Dan hovered weightlessly in front of a set of display screens like a man floating before a giant insect's segmented eye. Behind him, half a dozen technicians watched the panels that now controlled the entire factory's air, heat, electricity, and communications. Far down the long line of consoles, almost lost to Dan's sight by the bend of the curving room, Lucita stood in front of a communications screen, her blue-jeaned legs wrapped around an anchor post. Dan could make out her father's face in the screen, drained almost white, eyes bleary. He put out a hand to steady himself as his body drifted slightly. Over his head, another set of screens showed the sight that he still found almost unbelievable. 8 spacecraft, ranging in size from little flitters to big delta-wing shuttles, converging on Nueva Venezuela. They bore the markings of the Pan-Arab Federation, Polynesia, the United African States, India, and Japan. Every spacefaring nation or group of nations. A message for you, boss, called one of the communications technicians, a woman. It's from the Japanese shuttle. Sorry, I...